All right, so you've now read about Somalia, which I thought was a lot of fun when I started reading about it. I should say, sort of, in terms of my sequence, this really started, I guess it was 2 years ago, when a student did a paper on Somalia. Apparently her father had been involved in it and had actually done a film. I don't know if it's available anywhere on Somalia. And she was using his information in Van Noten, it was one of my sources, to do a paper. And when I started working on my chapter, I was a little worried about Van Noten, because he was a Dutch lawyer and obviously a libertarian who spent the last 12 years of his life in Somalia married to a Somali wife. And his book was unfinished when he died, and it was then edited by another libertarian, someone I know slightly. And I don't trust people who agree with me too much, because I'm likely to be biased in not seeing their biases, as it were. And I also didn't know how much of it was Van Noten and how much was the editor, which is sort of hard to tell reading a book like that. But I then came across, doing library research, I.M. Lewis, who is pretty clearly the world's leading expert on traditional Somali system. He's a London School of Economics, now retired professor, an anthropologist, who has been researching Somalia since the 1950s and writing books about it. I think he's written about 20 books, of which I think most of them are about Somalia, probably not all. And when I was looking in the library, when I finally found a book on Somalia that wasn't written by him, it was a festschrift in his honor by other people, a collection of articles. And as far as I could tell, his picture wasn't all that different from Van Noten's picture. Van Noten has got a much more limited view of it, because he really is describing his wife's clan, which is the people he was living with. And whereas Lewis, although he's mostly specializing in the north, the basic division is that the northern part of Somalia is herders, is basically camel herders plus some sheep and goats and such. And the southern, with very little agriculture, and the southern part is a mix of herding and agriculture. The northern part was a British colony, the southern part was an Italian colony. So there are significant differences sort of in Somalia. And as I say, Lewis does discuss the south, but I think it's pretty clear that his central interest was really the northern herding cultures. And it's clear that he liked them and sort of, you know, on the whole thought that it was interesting and in some ways admirable. So that was what I got into. And then the chapter at this point is really based a good deal more heavily on Lewis than on Van Noten, although Van Noten gives, in a sense, a more detailed picture of the particular slice of Somali society that he evolved than Lewis, that he observed that Lewis is in a position to give. My impression from Lewis's earlier stuff is that what was happening with the British occupation, I think it may have been a protectorate or something, I don't think it was officially a colony, or at least I think it was like, you know, UN had authorized to protect it, take care of it, is that the British officials mostly let the Somali run stuff themselves with sort of some top-level intervention. And there was sort of an interesting discussion of the Somalis gaming the British, that he said that one of the things that would happen would be the British would be informed by Somali informants that there was going to be a clash between two Somali groups, but the information would be fed to them late enough so that they would arrive after the initial attack in time to stop the counterattack. And in general, it's one of the things I thought was sort of fun reading about the Somali is that people like the Icelanders aren't around anymore. That is, the Saga period Icelanders or the ancient Irish. The Somalis still are. When I came back here this fall for a couple of days, because I was spending the fall in Virginia, my cab driver was Somali and was a little surprised that I actually knew something about Somalia. He was from Puntland, as I remember, which is the northeast corner of Somalia. The current situation is that most of the north is the Republic of Somaliland, which regards itself as an independent state, is treated by the rest of the world as a somewhat autonomous province of an imaginary country called Somalia. It's clear reading Lewis's recent stuff. I did a little updating of the chapter today, including links to a couple of web things that you might find interesting, one of which is a discussion from, I think, about 2 years ago by Lewis of the situation in Somalia. Clearly, he's a partisan of the Republic of Somaliland, and certainly his view is that the Somalis, left to their own resources in the north, successfully set up a reasonably, by Horn of Africa standards, peaceful, successful society, and the UN and the US and everybody else refused to recognize it because we wanted to compel Somalia to end up as one country. And the UN then kept trying to set up governments for Somalia in Mogadishu, which were all essentially foreign inventions, not actual Somali governments, and every one of which then collapses. So his view pretty clearly is that the villains in the story are the UN, not the Somalis, and that the Republic of Somaliland, where they were more left alone and weren't getting any foreign aid or help or whatever, did at least tolerably. Tolerably well. Yeah?
I was wondering while I was reading it, where the pirates...
Yes, that's a.
From the north?
Are they the camel herders? Yeah. I was. Well, they can't be really from the south because they need a coast.
Yeah.
So I guess they could be on the east coast. Yep. They could be on the east coast. It sounds. I did a little reading on this, and it sounds as though they may well be from Puntland and from areas just a little south of that that would be outside of the Somaliland Puntland. Puntland, which is the northeast corner, regards itself as an autonomous province of Somalia. That is, in fact, is running its own affairs, but unlike Somaliland, it doesn't think it's an independent country or claim to be recognized as one. And it sounded from the stuff I looked at as though the only people who were being, where the authorities are being accused of going along with the pirates are what I think is about the northern end of the Somalia area. And that both Somaliland and Puntland, at least the webbed piece, which I found, which I think was a Wikipedia piece, seem to think we're making efforts to suppress piracy. But I assume that the pirates have got to be based on the coast, and that presumably is going to be either Somaliland, Puntland, or the east coast of Somalia, sort of the northeast coast of Somalia, just south of Puntland. But the claim was that some of the officials in, if I understood it correctly, a region of Somalia below Puntland, I think, were cooperating with the pirates, basically trying to ally with them against other factions within Somalia was the implication.
Does anyone know if the pirates are acting on, do they consider themselves pirates?
That's interesting. The claim I've seen, but I have no idea if it's really their view of it, or defenders of their view of it, is that foreign ships dump a lot of pollution into the coastal waters off Somalia, and that the Somali fishermen felt, well, if they're going to destroy our fishing, we're entitled to attack them and get some money out of that. And the impression, it sounded as though the most favorable view of the pirates is that that's how they started out, but it turned out to be a profitable way of making a living and therefore expanded as a result. But whether that's right, I just don't know. Lewis, I don't remember if Lewis ever discusses the piracy. It certainly isn't at all central to what he's doing. It would make sense that the fishermen would be obviously able to do it because they got boats and, you know, experience and so forth.
I was wondering when I was reading it, if there was a link between what the pirates were doing and the laws described.
That would be interesting. No, that would be very interesting because I do have in that appendix the bit about Somali interacting with the Ethiopian government and their feeling that they were acting according to their system. Yeah, one of the things I don't really discuss but is sort of relevant to the background, there's a sizable Somali population inside Ethiopia, ethnically Somali population. And the actual sequence of events is that in, I think, about 1960, Italy and Britain pull out. And their two protectorates are combined into the country of Somalia with a more or less conventional sort of Western democratic government. And that lasts more or less for about 9 years, as I remember, at which point Siad Barre, who I think is a military officer, takes over as dictator. And he runs things for a fair while and eventually gets into a war with Ethiopia. And what I think is going on, if I've got the story right, is that he was backed by the Soviet Union, was sort of a Soviet, not really a satellite, but one of the client states in Africa. He gets into a war with Ethiopia, at which point the Soviets decide they'd rather back Ethiopia. I'm not sure what Ethiopia had been doing before, but at that point, maybe just a more valuable client. So the Soviets stop arming the Barre's people, start arming Ethiopians. The Ethiopians basically win the war, and that creates enough unhappiness in Somalia to set off a series of risings that eventually overthrow Barre. Since then, there really hasn't been a government of Somalia. There's been eventually the people in the north form Republic of Somaliland, but for Somalia as a whole, there have been various groups claiming to be governments. And I guess my interpretation is that what destabilizes the traditional system is really the combination of the idea of a central government, at which point, if there's going to be a central government, we want us to be the ones running it, because that way we tax instead of getting taxed, and Barry had sort of demonstrated the virtue of that. And so you have really clan-based coalitions that are trying to establish themselves, along with the fact that the UN keeps meddling because it insists on having a central government that it approves of, so that at the one point at which the so-called something or other of Islamic courts had actually established more or less peace and quiet in Mogadishu, the UN and the US subsidized the Ethiopians to come in and attack. And how much of that is because it was called, it had Islamic in its title, and therefore the U.S. assumed that it's got to be enemies of ours, and how much was for other reasons, I just can't follow. In general, I mean, Lewis is sort of very negative on the whole sort of foreign intervention. He thinks it's being done by people who don't understand the society and are more or less messing things up, and the people who are doing it are mostly living in comfort outside Somalia, because it's not safe for them to try to live inside Somalia. Anyway, that's... that stuff was interesting, but really my central interest for this course is not the... I mean, the current stuff is interesting only because people who don't know anything about it always say, well, look, this shows that you need a good central government because look how the anarchy breaks down. And that's really almost a play on words, because anarchy has two different meanings. One of them is society without government, and the other is chaos. And people take it for granted the two are the same, and it's clear they aren't the same, that there have been various... pre-modern, non-modern societies which didn't have governments and, you know, functioned about as well as the societies with governments in all different ways. But in any case, my interest was really, my serious professional interest is really in trying to understand how that system worked as another and quite different example of a feud system from the other feud systems we've looked at. So let me stop talking for a minute, which I know it's hard to get back to, and see if you had points you wanted to raise, and if you don't have points you wanted to raise, I had various points I was going to discuss. So were there things about Somalia other than your question about pirates, which is sort of... Yes?
So you mentioned that you've got a low end of 300 people in the diet paying group,
yes,
and a maximum of about 3,000.
Yes.
That strikes me as a pretty common sort of number in human societies in general.
Uh-huh.
And that you've got this sort of range, which is approximately the low end size of a tribe in the American Indians, is right, 300. And admittedly, there were larger organizations than 3,000 warriors, but not many. So.
Yeah, the Cheyenne, I think the total population of Emmerich is about 10,000, but of course that isn't all adult males, so it'd be comparable to your 3,000 figure.
So, anyways, it struck me as is highly interesting
that part of what intrigued me as an economist, and that Lewis is explicitly discussing, is the trade-off between economies and diseconomies of scale. That if you think about, I don't know how many of you are familiar with economics, but if you think about sort of ordinary industries, there's some tendency for non-economists to assume that monopoly is the natural state of the world. That sort of the bigger you are, the more profitable you are. And it isn't true. If you actually look at real industries, it turns out that there are some industries where below a fairly small size, when you get bigger, your costs go up rather than down because of the coordination problems, the distance sort of between the president and the factory floor. There are other ones where, for various technical reasons, as you get bigger, you get efficiencies of scale. And the normal sort of conventional economic view of an economy is that an industry where economies of scale don't go very far up is going to be an industry with lots of small firms. One where they go pretty far up is one with a small number of large firms and so forth. And that's sort of a common economic pattern. It's intriguing to try to apply it to political institutions. And you try to say, you know, what are the economies of scale for a country? What are the economies of scale for an army? What are things of that sort? And the story he's telling, at least, is that the advantage of getting bigger for a DIA-paying group, for assuming people follow the DIA-paying group, is the coalition which is responsible for making sure that the obligations of its... You have a system where if I commit an offense against you, once we've settled what's happening, I owe a damage payment, just like our tort law. And the DIA-paying group really has two roles. One of them is to make sure that its members' obligations are paid, which it does partly by sharing some of those obligations across the group. They aren't entirely sort of like an insurance system. They're not entirely to the individual who's taking the action, and partly by pressuring their own members to make sure it gets paid. And their other half is to make sure that monies owed to them are paid by being willing to use the threat of violent force against an individual or his group who has committed an offense, owes a damage payment, and hasn't paid it. And the advantages of increasing size are, first, better insurance, that you're spreading out these payments over more people, and you're talking about payments of sort of on the order of 100 camels. I'm not sure. Interesting question is how high the average camel herd is, how much one person has, and I could probably answer that if I looked through some of Lewis's books, which I've got one form or another. But
100 camels is a very large.
It's not a trivial sum. That's right. Well, I'm not sure if that's right from the description of how it's done. That's one of the things I don't really have in the chapter, and probably should, although it's not exactly legal, is a clearer description of sort of how that society functions economically. Because the basic pattern for the northeast or the northern herders is that you've got that all of the young, of the youths and young adult men are spending a sizable part of the year as nomadic camel herders. And camels can go for several days without water. And so they're essentially herding them over a fairly large area from one water source to another, one source of grazing to another. Meanwhile, the, I think, older adult men, women, and children are much less mobile, and they have the sheep and goats, which can't move as far from water and are therefore much more restricted. And if I remember correctly, I think there's some point of the year when the two groups come back together, but for a good deal of the year, you've essentially got the teens through maybe early 20s males in one group herding camels, and the rest of the population in tighter clusters elsewhere. Not necessarily towns. There are towns, but you also have what sound like camps, essentially, of a number of family groups. It's a polygynous society, so that there may be one husband and several wives. I think, if I've got it right, that the whole family, including multiple wives, not including the camel herding group, are located in one area, but I think the wives have basically separate houses and sort of separate subunits within that with their children. It's interesting reading about it just in terms of sort of seeing what a very different society looks like, but it seemed to me that for my purposes in this book, I really wanted to focus mostly on the legal institutions. I probably need a little bit more of the other stuff as well. But anyway, I think I could probably find figures on the size of camel herds, but it's enough so that there's much to be said for having a reasonable number of people to divide it. You know?
I was wondering about these groups. You talked about a number of ways that they either splinter or form.
Right.
I was wondering both how often that sort of thing happened and whether you had any actual real-life stories.
Yeah.
It was all described very much.
Yes. The answer is I don't, because I wasn't looking for it, but you might find that. I'm not sure. But no, it sounded as though a lot of the changing really was not random at all. That what was happening was that my DIA paying group, somebody in my DIA paying group has a conflict with somebody in your DIA paying group, so we're opposed. A while later, someone in my DIA paying group has a conflict with somebody in a group whose kinship splits from ours above the split between yours and mine, and he's got a pretty large group backing him, and we don't have enough people, so you and we coalesce for that quarrel, as it were. And I'm not sure if we actually write a new contract. Maybe we do. That wasn't entirely clear. And then later we quarrel, and so it splits up again. So it's saying that it was sort of intriguing to try to see how the kinship system is interacting with other things, because it's sort of tempting. But of course, some of that, if you think about it, happens in our system too. It's not kinship. There's this quote from somebody that the genealogy in Somalia is what the address is in Europe. And if you think about the sense in which, if you're English, you naturally think of the rest of the English as allies. You're not so sure about the Scots and the Welsh. Britain is involved in a war with somebody, now it's the British who are all allies. Britain is involved in a war with Germany, well now it's the British and the French and the Danes and the Norwegians who are allies, so to speak, eventually. So there's a sense in which you're getting a similar kind of pattern of, and I'm sure within England, that there are, say, political conflicts where London is opposed to the North or something. I don't know enough about English politics to know. So in that sense, the pattern really is almost a universal human pattern. It's just that if you have a nomadic population, in a sense, geography is much more fluid. It's not as obvious a function. You need something else to organize your alliances out of. And so they're doing it out of kinship. And I was intrigued sort of by the contrast to Iceland. In Iceland, you've got a little bit of kinship in the sense that you will have a 40-year-old couple and their adult children with maybe their children who are living in a fairly close cluster, maybe sharing a house, and are probably all allies when a conflict occurs, although there may be tension within that group as well. But you don't have it much beyond that. It doesn't look as though the descendants of your great-grandfather are your natural allies. Your allies could just as easily be the guy who you went a Viking with when you were young, or people who married, or for other reasons, maybe members of your Gathord would tend to have something to be allies and so forth. Whereas the Somali system, the sort of basic structure is this agnatic kinship, descendant in the male line, and then, but that doesn't fully define it. That sort of says who are the candidates for alliance, as it were. And then the actual alliances are going to depend on who gets along with whom and how many people you need and a bunch of other stuff of that sort. But it's clear from the descriptions that a random, Somali 12-year-old can tell you his genealogy for 20 generations or so up, only up the male line. He may or may not know about the female. Female links do affect things, but they don't affect things as strongly. But basically, if you can't form a large enough coalition out of your agnatic kinship, suppose your group has a common great-grandfather with our group and we're quarreling, but your group, they were more successful, so you've got twice as many people in your branch of the genealogy than ours. We need some help. So we go to the agnatic kinship group of my mother's brother, say. That's apparently maternal uncle is seen as a fairly close relationship. And so that gives you what they refer to as uterine alliances through the uterus rather than through the male fathers. So it's more complicated than that, as it were. And you've got what they refer to as a pile of shields, which is a purely opportunistic coalition, where it's just we need enough people and, anybody will comes. And it sort of sounds as though you might have some subgroups within the tree who get kicked out of their DFA group. They were too quarrelsome or something, and people didn't like to keep paying their fines.
Right. That's something that I was most curious about. So it sounded like if you had done something wrong and for whatever reason your group suddenly thought you were in the wrong also, they would just not pay your fines.
Well, I don't think so. If I've got it correctly, and judging this what I read, what happens is they pay your fine and they then say we're not responsible for you hereafter.
Yeah.
I think that's what's going on, because otherwise there'd be too much of a temptation just to back up to avoid paying, to default on the insurance contract, as it were. Whereas, no, what intrigued me about it is the comparison to outlawry. As I say, what struck me a lot was the differences and similarities with the Icelandic case, because they're both feud systems. They're both systems where they're Iceland has a central, quote, government, but it doesn't have any executive body of government. And Somalia didn't even have that in the traditional system. But on the other hand, they're very different feud systems, different instantiation of the same underlying principle. But in both of them, what enforces the rules is the force, or is private force, or the threat of private force. In both of them, it's done by coalitions in practice. But in the Somali system, the law is customary law, plus some Islamic law. In the Icelandic system, you have an explicit legislature, an explicit, though oral for much of the period, law code. Law code can be amended. In the Somali system, the courts seem to be sort of ad hoc in the sense that you can more or less predict who's likely to be it, but it isn't like there's a functioning court system that's sitting there. Maybe there is for the Islamic stuff, I'm not sure, but that normally what's happening is my group and your group agree on some elders of our groups who will make up the court, and that court then gives a verdict. Whereas the Icelandic system, you've got an explicit court system, a neat tree hierarchy of the thing court, the quarter court, the fifth court, and so forth. So they're sort of very different in that way. in the Icelandic one, in a sense, the ultimate sanction for people who act badly is outlawry, where badly doesn't mean committing offenses, but committing offenses and not paying for them. In the Somali system, instead of having outlawry imposed by a court, I'm not sure, maybe that could happen too, I'm not certain about it, but it looks as though the closer equivalent to outlawry is that you're outlawed by your dia-paying group, not by the court. That your group says, this guy's a troublemaker, he's useful fighting for us, we have to fight, but he's killed two people, we had to pay large fines for that, he injured a third person, he'll doubtless hurt somebody else tomorrow, he's out of our group, we're no longer responsible for him. And now he's got a real problem, because that also means that if somebody commits an offense against him, there is nobody who is going to force them to pay damages for it. And so what does he do? Well, maybe he leaves town, and maybe he can find a different dia-paying group that's willing to let him in. Maybe he can. Maybe he goes abroad or something. But it was sort of interesting, again, the way you've got it in a way of parallelism, and yet through a different set of mechanics, as it were, which is part of what made it fun. So,
this part is a good essay to write, the compare and contrast.
Yes, Well, to some extent...
I missed that part about how the outlawry works. One is imposed by the court, the other is imposed by its own, by the internal private...
That's right. Yes. To some extent, we haven't gotten to the thread chapter that covers feud societies, and I do some of that, but I think I ought to expand that. I think when I was thinking what to talk about today, it seemed to me I saw a longer list of interesting parallels and differences. Other things that struck people? If I go back for a moment, the other differences. Yeah.
Let's talk for a bit about the use of
yes, because that's determining the presumptive coalitions. That is to say, the people, for example, the sort of the simplest level, I get killed, who gets to collect the blood money? And there will be some rules which will have been established by contract within the dia-paying group, but there'll be something like a third of the blood money goes to my sons, brothers, and uncles, say. Another third goes to the descendants of my great-grandfather, which is, I think, roughly speaking, the group below the dia-paying group, and the rest is divided among the dia-paying group.
But that's not actually written down anywhere.
It is.
I thought it was orally memorized.
Probably was in the past, but in the period where Lewis is observing it, which is under British occupation, it seems to have been common that the contract was actually filed with the British authorities. That's where I can quote one. I quote one of the contracts at the end of the chapter, and that was apparently one of the ones. And Lewis thinks they may have been sometimes written before and kept in the shrines of local saints, but he isn't sure about that. So it was at least partly oral and maybe partly written. But basically, we want to form a coalition to roughly vindicate its members' rights, the simplest way of putting it. And how do we form the coalition? Well, the first natural group is the descendants of my grandfather. And in order to know who's in that group, I got to know my genealogy and you got to know yours. I meet a stranger. I'd like to know, is he a likely ally or not? Well, we compare genealogies. Turns out we got the same great-grandfather in the agnatic line. The nice thing about paternal kinship is it's only a single line. You don't have to memorize a branching tree. So we now know that, so we know just as if we had discovered that we both lived in Chicago. In that sense, it's like an address. So we've got something in common, and the result is that it's quite likely that at some future point we'll be allies. Can't be sure, but you're a likely member of the coalition that will form if I end up in a quarrel with somebody whose links are higher up the tree than yours are. I mean, that's going to be the logic of what's happening. And it goes all the way up to clans, where the clans are likely to be hundreds of thousands of people who at least believe that they have a common descent, nine, whatever links up. Now, some of the genealogy, if Lewis is right, is fictional. That one of the things that I found sort of interesting is that it sounds as though all or almost all clans trace their descent way, way, way up to a supposed Arab. And this Arab is somebody who was shipwrecked or who fled Arabia because of a feud or something of that sort, and it's somebody who has some connection to important Islamic figures. It's somebody who was one of the companions of the Prophet, or is a grandson of a companion of the Prophet, or has some other connection. So it looks, and at least Lewis seems to think these are probably invented, that this is probably the idea that they're Muslims, that Arabs, and especially Arabs connected to Muhammad, are therefore high-status people. So how do we make our clan seem higher status? We have this story in which we trace it back in its very beginning to such a person. But it sounds as though it's also true that it's fictional in the sense that if you check multiple people's genealogies, they aren't fully consistent. And he thinks that what's happening is that you drop links that don't matter. So if somebody has only one son who has only one son, it doesn't. You don't have to remember the guy in the middle, because everybody who's descended from him is also descended from this one. In fact, you don't even, I guess you do have to remember this one, because this will have multiple lines. Well, if this one had only one son as well, you could drop two of them. And so you will have that between point A and point B, the number of links will be different for different people's genealogies, even though they've got the same person up here. And he thinks that what's happening is that when a group is not very productive, as it were, its genealogy in effect shortens. So it's not perfectly reliable. But he does, I think, at some point have some attempts where you've got points in the genealogy which have people who you have some basis for historically identifying. And he thinks that the longer genealogies are about right, that the length of the number of generations is plausible for the length of time involved. But I was going to say that one of the things I found sort of fun coming out of the fact that they're still around is you can see how we look to them. That it's natural for us to sort of think of ourselves as the lords of creation, and, you know, these people a long time ago, they were sort of backwards and all the rest of it. Doesn't follow they would have agreed with us. And one of the things I thought was sort of funny is that they've got this term, a pile of shields, which describes an ad hoc coalition, which pretty clearly they think of as, you know, it's a legitimate thing to do, but it's not really as proper as a good agnostic coalition. Well, that's the term that they used for the British Commonwealth and for the American alliance against the Soviets. That both of those were piles of shields. And of course, they're right, because they are ad hoc, the British Commonwealth not entirely, but by this time, the British Commonwealth is largely non-British. If you think about, I mean, Canada is largely descendants of people from Britain, but India isn't. And the various African countries weren't, and so forth. So, but I thought it was sort of funny in that respect. And it's pretty clear reading the books that the Somali in general have a high opinion of themselves. Now, this may not be different from anybody else. I mean, the French have a high opinion of themselves, too. And I was just actually, I've been rereading my parents' autobiography, and they're mentioning some meetings in Italy at which everybody in the meeting gave their papers in English except the French. And that it was clear that a Frenchman who gave his paper in English would get a lot of hostility from the other French people at the conference. But again, the Somali pretty clearly are sort of... And you can see that in a sense, some of that makes sense in the institutions. If you think about a feud system, it's important to make it clear that you're not the sort of person who gets pushed around. Because if you are, people will say, well, if we wrong him, he's not going to do anything about it, so he's a patsy. And that therefore, I wouldn't be very interesting question. I don't know enough to be sure, but to see to what extent the sort of distribution of personality types in a feud-style society is noticeably different from a society where most rights enforcement is done by a higher power, by the king or the police or whoever. When you really got noticeable differences, would be sort of a fun thing to investigate if you could. Not within my areas of expertise. But anyway, as I said, the Somali pretty clearly have a high opinion of themselves. And did not think of the British occupiers as their superiors, but just as, you know, another set of people you've got to deal with. And, you know, they're part of our game as well, as it were. So they say the differences... They're both feud systems. They're both fine systems. They're both systems in which the normal outcome of a conflict is that somebody pays damage to somebody else. And it sounded as though there were cases that clearly you could have in any system like this, that instead of going after blood money, we just kill the guy who killed one of our people, and then presumably the blood money's canceled. And you have that explicitly in the sagas. I think I mentioned the killing duel in the Njalsaga, where you have several people killed on both sides with the purse of silver being passed back and forth by the husbands who are friends and their wives aren't, and are provoking the killings. And in this system, it sounds as though occasionally the court verdict will basically be that somebody should get killed rather than pay. But the normal outcome in all of these is payment. And, of course, one reason for that is that that gives you an incentive to enforce your right. In addition to wanting a reputation for enforcing your rights, you're also going to get something out of it. And you need, in any system, you need an incentive to enforce. That's one of my thread chapters, really, is in different systems, what is the incentive to enforce the rules? Because if there's no incentive to enforce the rules, they don't get enforced. But if there's too much incentive to enforce the rules, you are going to sue innocent people as well as guilty people in the hopes of being able to get stuff out of them. And that's an intriguing, for me at least, one of the intriguing issues that comes out of these different things are the different mechanisms that different societies use, both to get the incentive and to limit it. Yeah?
Thought while you were talking, one of the disadvantages of a system based on genealogy versus location is it's very difficult to move away from conflict. It's very difficult to end the conflict. If your conflict is based on your genealogical relation or your lack of genealogical relation with some person, not based on geography, you can't simply move to a different part of the country and say, I'm no longer part of that conflict. Your conflict is still after you.
On the other hand, if it's clear enough, you can shift diapay groups. You can say that I and the other descendants of my grandfather have decided we don't want to get involved in this conflict that is being set up by descendants of my great or great great grandfather or something. So we are going to withdraw from the diapaying group we were in, join another diapaying group that joins us in the kinship structure somewhere else.
Yeah, well,
so you've got some.
In Europe, there's a very common attitude. I mean, there's a great deal of literature about the difficulty people have in moving to a new location in Europe and the hostility of the locals. Oh, you're not from this region, et cetera, et cetera. You're always sort of this outsider. But you're quite literally there, and there's a good chance that the city comes under attack. They're not going to throw you out of the city walls. You're actually going to get, you know, defended by the army as well as that. But on the Somali system, where it's probably based on genealogy, even they move down south of Mogadishu or up north of Puntland, it doesn't matter. Your genealogy group is what's going to protect you, regardless or not.
But who in your genealogy group does it is really going to vary. That is, if you move to somewhere where there's almost nobody of your clan, you've got a problem. But although I think there are mechanisms for being sort of not literally adopted in, but I think if you marry into a clan, you get some privileges associated, although nothing like the full ones, because I think that's what Van Noten did, basically, as a foreigner. For example, the property, as I say, the grazing is mostly a commons, although to some extent thought of as the property of a clan, rather vaguely defined, but not within that. But there are smaller patches of agricultural land that are to some extent private property, and one of the patterns is they can only be sold to another clan member or someone associated with the clan, such as the husband of a clan member. So that you're getting a little blurring in that degree. But, you know, they're to some extent, that's right. It's becoming much less geographical and more kinship-based system. So again, another difference with the Icelandic case is that the Icelandic case, at least nominally, the payment seems to be by the offender, although my guess is that in practice his allies are likely to help him out if he doesn't have the money to do it, whereas the Somali... I mean, it's interesting because in a sense the court and law system, the Icelandic, is more formalized than the Somali, whereas the coalition system is less formalized. That the Somali system, you know, there's this contract who says when I've got to pay blood money how the burden is shared among my kin, whereas the Icelandic, all you have is, will my kin help me out? I think that's what I think is going on anyway. So that was sort of another interesting, one of many interesting differences. We'll be talking about the Irish system later, the early Irish system. And that we know a lot less about, and so there's more speculation. And I was sort of amused by the fact that there were two features of the early Irish system which are echoed pretty closely in the Somali system. And I was making various comments about just how far the Celts got. Because the Celts did get pretty far. I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but there are like three different places. What's the term? There's a geographical name which exists in Spain, I think in Poland, and somewhere else. And it's all the same name, and these were all places where, at some point, the relevant Celtic group was.
Turkey.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. But I don't think as far as the Horn of Africa. I think the causal link there is with the Arabs, because the Horn of Africa is very close by sea to Arabia. They converted to Islam fairly early, and it's pretty clear that there was interaction from early on. And actually, I was one of the things that I linked to, I did a little editing of the chapter today and uploaded the slightly edited version, which you might want to look at, but in particular I put in a couple of links on to modern stuff. And it sounds as though Lewis thinks that the what's going on with El Shahab, which is a Islamic fundamentalist group that's there now fighting the UN and its people, is that El Shahab is really sponsored by the Saudis and is representing a different version of Islam than the dominant version in Somalia, but they've got money to subsidize it and therefore can get people to fight for them. And that pretty clearly Lewis thinks that if you sort of left them alone, they'd have a hard time maintaining themselves in Somalia, given that many of their policies are not consistent with the traditional Somali version of Islam. So, let's see. So the Irish system, the two things that struck me, one of them is the idea that when you injure somebody, you now have to host him. You've got to basically invite him to be your guest, maintain the household in a fashion suitable for a recovering injured person, keep things reasonably quiet. If he's an important person, you have to host not only him, but a suitable retinue for somebody of his importance. And you've got to provide him with medical care and so forth. And my impression is that in the Irish case, at some point, that's getting replaced by money payments. But that was at least the initial rule, and you observe the same rule with the Somalia in a similar case. And then the fact that the basic group for the Irish is the Fine, however it's pronounced, which is, I think, descendants of a common great-grandfather, if I remember. So that's, again, a similar descendants in the male line. So it's a similar agnotic kinship system. Now, you would think the uterine kinship makes more sense because, after all, paternity is a speculation, whereas maternity is a fact. Now, nowadays, that's changed. We now have paternity testing, so actually paternity is now a fact. But it hasn't been true until recently, and so there's a real advantage for doing it through the maternal line, but that's the less common pattern historically, I think. I think those are most of the Icelandic versus Somali points that struck me. Other things? Yes?
Well, I just wanted to make a clarification. So I was rereading this morning about the feud component, and there's between footnote 22 and 23, there's a bit of grammatical ambiguity, so I just want to clarify that. This is where you say that families are obligated to defend their kin, but not to help attack their opponents.
Right.
So is the option to not attack the opponents discretionary, or are they obligated?
Oh no, I think discretionary. I think Van Noten's claim is basically that, in terms of their ethical system, really, you have an obligation if you're. Now, how far kin goes, I don't know, and it sounds as though the explicit dia paying contractual system might oblige you to attack somebody who refused to pay damages, but that it's and again, Van Noten, I think, does not understand the system as well as Lewis. He's not a professional anthropologist or somebody living in the system who's interested in it. But it sounds as though, for a given degree of kinship, I am more likely to join in to help you if you're attacked than I am in to join in to help you if you are attacked and somebody else and want help to be attacked. And that's what I think is the claim being made.
And that's how I read it the first time. Yep. But then I thought, as we're going through this, through the rest of the mechanics of the entire system.
Yes.
If that option is exercised and someone and his other members of the same DFA group attacked somebody else to address some sort of grievance, how would an internal conflict like that be addressed?
There are certainly conflicts within a DFA group, and the contract that I had explicitly stated, you know, what happens. But I think if a member of my DFA group has committed an offense and is being attacked, what we're supposed to do is to arrange to have the matter settled. We're supposed to pay the fine. And I guess, suppose a member of my DA paying group commits an offense or is accused of an offense, and the two sides can't agree on the court. That's going to be the place where you would expect violence might arise. And I guess that normally my DA paying group is going to defend me in that case, subject to whatever the contract that for that DA paying group specifies.
I am talking about that second example, but in a different court, where a member of your DA paying group is accused and the sides cannot agree on the court or some other important component of solving the dispute. In my DA paying group, then, there are different subsets. One wants to continue trying to negotiate, and the other wants to exercise the option to attack our opponent.
So what happens?
How is this set
up? No, that is... Lewis seems to imply that some issues you have sort of an open meeting of all the males and majority vote prevails, whereas Van Noten seems to see it more as consensus system. So maybe I wouldn't be astonished if the answer is that the DA paying group's contract specifies whether you can or not. The comment is made with regard to the clan level, the sort of top level thing, that you will have basically clan the elders from lots of subgroups within the clan meeting together on something. And that if a consensus is reached but some people disagree, then they and their kin subgroup aren't obliged to help with the resulting conflict. So presumably, if I have to guess, it's that some of this gets solved by people pulling out of the group when they disagree, and some of it gets solved by something like a majority vote or a consensus, and people saying, well, I don't really like it, but I'll...
I think it's probably one of the factors that causes the max-sized groups to...
That's right. No, pretty clearly he's implying that the diseconomy, I mentioned the economy of scale, which is insurance and military force, and that the diseconomy of scale is internal cohesion. That the larger the group is, the more likely that there will be multiple people who want to be the leader in any given conflict and who end up feuding with each other. Think about the Republican primaries at the moment. All right. It's pretty clear, I think, that the candidates are in effect shooting each other. They're hurting themselves, that they're providing material that will make it easier for Obama in the election. But Ron Paul doesn't particularly want Santorum to be president. Santorum doesn't want Ron Paul to be president. And even though both of them would probably prefer the other one to Obama, they don't prefer it enough to overrule their desire to win themselves. And you can easily enough see that in a group like this, you would have similar kinds of things going on where there are disagreements on what should happen. I want the prestige of being the guy who everybody else follows when we have such a dispute. So do you. And that makes it harder to function in a group. So therefore, we lose out to a somewhat smaller group with more cohesion. But actually, that intrigued me because the whole question of economies of scale has a good deal to do with whether stateless societies are stable. That if you imagine a stateless society which ends up with two or three coalitions, strong coalitions with trust each other, that could pretty easily turn back into a government. Whereas if it ends up with 300 coalitions, it's going to be a lot harder for them to cartelize, as it were, and reestablish monopoly rule. So it's a question that interests me in general. Let me run through a little bit of the structure of the agnotic system, some of which I've already said, that I've got notes on this, that nobody else is interrupting me. Yes, good.
So I ran into an interesting quote from your section. Popeism saying, one can change one's religion, one cannot change the law, and between religion and tradition, choose tradition. Those are profoundly, profoundly disagreed with by Islamic thinkers. I mean, the idea that you can change your religion is actually something in apostasy, which is also like
apostasy,
in Iran and Iraq. The idea that the Somalis would blithely say is folk tradition, well, you can change your religion anytime you feel like it, but you can't change the law.
I don't know whether the Somali accept the idea that apostasy is a capital offense or not. I don't know that. It might be that but the change of religion, they're really thinking of changing the details of the religion rather. Because as far as I can tell, it doesn't sound as any sizable non-Muslim population in Somalia, or has been recently, although there have been various... Ethiopia, of course, has been Christian for
and southern Sudan.
1600 years or something.
Yeah,
Ethiopia is the important one in a sense because it's got a big Somali population. It's interacted with Somalis. You've had points in history when Somalis were conquering Ethiopia and points, I think, when Ethiopia was conquering Somalia. So it may be that that's where that's coming out of, that you're thinking of the Ethiopian Christians as an alternative. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Somali in Ethiopia are Christians. I don't know. But it actually reminds me of the Icelanders, because there's a similar quote from one of the prominent Icelanders, and I think this had to do either with appointing priests or controlling churches, because basically what happens in Iceland after they go Christian, if I remember correctly, is that some local leader donates land for a church. And he then has effective control over the appointment of the priest for that church. And there's some point at which the Catholic hierarchy is objecting to this system. And I don't swear that it's that part they're objecting, though I think it is. And some prominent Icelander says, I don't see why the opinion of some priest in Rome should preside over the custom of our ancestors. So you get that kind of attitude, at least, in the Icelandic case as well. And, you know, Rome was a long distance away. Very few of them have been there. And like the Somali, I think they have a high opinion of their own society. And probably the Irish, too, I suspect, and many other cultures, not surprisingly. So in any case, it was interesting. And again, it's pretty clear that there are areas where the Somalis simply ignore Sharia, that their inheritance rules are not the same as the Sharia inheritance rules, that camels only go to men instead of a third of them going to women, which I think would be the Sharia rule. That's assuming one son and one daughter. That sons, I think, under Sharia get twice the inheritance of the daughters, as I recall. My impression is that Muhammad's alterations of pre-existing Arab law were on the whole pro-women, not anti-women. That things like that, I think it was going from no claim to inheritance to a third claim to inheritance. And one of the things that strikes me is that although the Somali ethnically don't seem to have much connection to the Arabs, as far as you can tell by looking at them, that culturally they do. What do the Bedouin do for a living? They herd camels. What do the northern Somali do for a living? They herd camels. So they're not the same. The Bedouin system is, I think, a much more tribal system than the Somali system is. But there were a lot of similarities, and it may well be that in effect you've got a common set of traditional laws that grow up from that kind of set of economic institutions, and the Somali are willing to modify them some, but not to an unlimited amount, in respect to Muslim law and Muslim teaching. And the set of fines looks as though it's largely copied from Sharia, but with some differences, was my impression. In particular, the detailed rules for what fraction of the full payment goes for various injuries are not the same as the... Now, I shouldn't speak too quickly, because, of course, the Sharia rules vary according to the four schools, and I was looking at a general summary. I haven't actually compared it to, I think it's Shafi'i, if I remember, whichever I do have in there somewhere, which of the schools the Somali adhere to, so that would be the comparison. So you have agnatic kinship is defined. One of the things kids do learn growing up is learn to memorize their genealogy. And the genealogy defines, as I say, the presumptive coalitions, the way you naturally coalesce, but not the way you have to coalesce, and provides a very simple mechanism for growing and shrinking coalitions, for saying we don't have enough people, all right, let's go one step further up the tree, let's see if those folk will ally with us against those foreigners who are related to us six steps up the tree or whatever they are, or maybe almost not at all. But then, yes, so you've got the mixture of that with contract, which again is sort of neat. There's a comment by Lewis somewhere that here Western political philosophers have been talking about contract theories of government forever. By God, here's a contract! Here are people who explicitly set up it's not a government, but their political structure by an explicit and sometimes even a written contract specifying the terms. And he thought that was sort of neat, which which it deserves. We already mentioned Van Noten's comment that one of the interesting questions in all of these systems is what stabilizes them. What prevents bigger and bigger coalitions, more and more widespread violence, and so forth. And it's not that it's impossible. In the Icelandic case, there's one sequence in, I think, the 11th century when you're expanding to coalitions large. There's a sense in which, as I see the Icelandic system, part of what normally makes it work is that most people are neutrals. And if most people are neutrals, then either side in a conflict which starts breaking the rules that everybody believes in is going to expand the coalition against them. So if you imagine a case where I've been outlawed, but my buddies are willing to support me anyway, even though it's illegal, and we fight with the other side, and a couple of people get hurt or killed, now what happens is the relatives of the people on the legal side sue the people on the illegal side for damages and win the cases. If those damages aren't paid, then those relatives come into the coalition on the other side. It doesn't work in the other direction because you lose your suit if you were defending an outlaw, which is not legal to do. So in that sense, you've got a natural stabilizing mechanism in which people who try to break the rules tend to expand the coalition against them. Yep.
I didn't see any stabilization mechanism, though, for the one license or two that
you
specifically talked about, right. The Ethiopian license.
Yes.
So how is it, just besides cooler heads prevailing, does that not escalate to incredibly violent exchanges between rivals?
That is presumably, as I guess the question is whether or not the side that loses two recognizes that their party was in the wrong. Because
sure, but like, let's say, I mean, you have a Hatfield McCoy situation with some families down there.
But it's got to be, from Lewis's description, this is only going to happen between clans. That is, it sounds from his description as though within clan, the system almost always works to get an agreed verdict. And so the problem really occurs in inter-clan things, and it sounds as though that's where you do sometimes get violence. But one stabilizing mechanism I didn't mention in the chapter, I thought was sort of interesting, in Lewis's description, I think, yes, this is when the British are still running things, I'm pretty sure, is that for some reason, which I now forget, you've got a fairly high level at one time in place of inter-clan violence. And so the clans agree to raise the weregeld. They agree to increase the blood money payment for killing somebody. It's not the Diyan, it's the Arabic term. I forget now what the Somali term is. I should say somewhere because I've got it in my sources. And so it looks as though that's a case where both sides are saying this violence is a problem. Both sides say, well, look, even though we're having a mess, probably when it's all settled, people will end up paying the fines. If the fines are larger, everybody will be more careful about not killing people. About, you know, killing as few people as possible. Going back to this line in Njal Saga about when you've killed as many people as you afford, if you can afford, we'll break up the fight. And that's the way of benefiting you. So that would be at least one stabilizing mechanism. But the other thing is that I suspect a lot of the stability depends on things like the weather. That if you have a serious drought, you've now got these sort of fuzzy claims by the clans to what's their grazing area. And if we have a serious drought and there's crops in your area and not in mine, I'm going to decide the fuzzy moves over a bit. And similarly, another source of conflict is that normally the rule for grazing is first come, first served. But my group of three teenagers and four young adult men and 60 camels arrives first, but your group with twice as many people arrives a little bit later, and you're really getting a little bit desperate, and so you decide to try to push us out. And you can see how things like that are going to create violence, and usually, at least if it's within the clan, it eventually gets settled, but you may get killed first. There's one of the throwaway lines in Lewis, which again may be out of quote, is that nowadays in the Horn of Africa, every adult male has an AK-47. And you can see that's going to make it riskier than when they were using spears.
Actually, that was one thing that I thought about, because, I mean, reading, you can't help but think of some more friends. And when we were talking about defense earlier, where your clans or your group might not necessarily come to your defense, it seems obvious that a person who's particularly passionate about being defensive, attacking someone else, needs more powerful weapons than the other side has, especially if he's going to be going on against
But pretty quickly, it sounds as though that's equalizing, because you had, at various points, both the Ethiopians and the Somali being fed weapons by the Soviets and probably by the U.S. at some points. You have the insurrection against Barry being supported by the Ethiopians, so they were almost certainly giving weapons to Somalis who were fighting against Barry. You have an open market, after all. You can import weapons. And you notice in some of these settlements, there's some quarrel and we agree to settle it, and part of the payment one side by another includes a gun. And so I could see there could be a transitional period, a point at which the person who involves in a lot of conflicts is willing to pay the cost of an expensive weapon and other people aren't. But my guess at this point is that there's nothing much more effective for their purposes than AK-47, that, you know, mortars aren't very useful against people on camels who are moving around, and that everybody who wants an AK-47 probably has one.
I was a little surprised, because after I read that, looked up the country ranking for Somalia with respect to private gun ownership.
Yes.
And they're actually in, depending on which year you calculate that from, they were in 54 to 60th.
Out of how many countries?
Out of 195 at the time that things were taken. So, obviously that's high. That's in the upper third, but...
Not as high as you might think. Ethiopia... I'm almost certain it's Ethiopia that there was a story like 10 or 20 years ago about somebody who tried to hijack an Ethiopian airplane and was shot down by the passengers. Half the passengers were carrying firearms. Just not the place you want to do a hijacking, unless you make sure that all the passengers are your people.
Well, there's another interesting statistic for gun ownership here, was that the site that I got my information from said it was 9.6 guns per 100 people. But only a tenth of a gun is registered per 100 people.
So how do they say how they do their estimating?
Based on licenses for obviously the registration.
What about for the non-registration?
And that is import-export and then seizures.
Yeah, it's going to be very... I'm just wondering if they've got the figures way too low, but I don't know, in the sense that if you imagine the way those people got the guns was the Soviets gave them to the Ethiopians, who gave them to the people they wanted to support in Somalia, I'm not sure there'd be any record by which we'd know about that. On the whole, I'm more inclined to trust Lewis's impression from his visits there and such. In a sense, one of the things which I guess I find encouraging is that this is a society where you could kill everybody like in an hour and a half, and yet although people do get killed, it's nonetheless a functioning society, and most of the people most of the time don't get shot. So in that sense, there are clearly fairly strong forces that reduce your willingness to actually shoot people, having to do with either having to pay damages or getting shot yourself or whatever else, even with very little de facto law enforcement at a sort of official level. I was also noticing comparison not just to Iceland but to Sharia, that one of the things that struck me as a little bit odd is that the Somali tradition, apparently you need three witnesses to establish a fact, whereas the Sharia, it's either four or two, depending on the particular bit of Sharia, and maybe that's just coming out of a customary law that predates the Islam. I was also noticing that the Somali use oaths, as do Jewish and Muslim systems. But there was sort of a neat bit in the Somali case that I hadn't remembered until I was rereading the chapter. And that's how you make people swear truthfully. And that's by having a penalty if it turns out after the fact that it wasn't true. So if you swear by your marriage, and I don't know how you establish it, but somehow it's established the oath was false, you're divorced automatically. And I thought that sort of approach, and I was wondering to what extent we have the same thing here. One of the things I think about in all these systems is, do they have ideas that we could steal? And you could certainly imagine a legal procedure. I mean, I would argue that in the Jewish case, of course, if it turns out you swore falsely, you don't get to swear again in future disputes, which is a real disadvantage, the handicap, because there are cases where, in order to win the case, you've got to swear an oath. And the question is, to what extent do we have mechanisms in our system where somebody can testify and raise the stakes on testifying? And the only thing that occurred to me is perjury. That is to say, all of the testimony in a trial pretty much is under oath. And in theory, if you testify falsely, you can be prosecuted. But in practice, it doesn't really happen much. Imagine that I swear to something, and 3 years later, it turns out that it wasn't true. My impression is the chance that I'll be charged with perjury is very close to zero.
That's why it was so odd that the federal government actually went after Martha Stewart on the perjury charge, as well as Cheney's former aide on perjury.
Yep.
Extremely rare.
Yep.
Because
I wonder that suppose you did it not in the form of everybody's form, which you already have, but sort of the additional oath, which is what's happening in the Jewish system. Say you say, all right, you've testified that. That's fine. Now, do you tell us it's really true? And by the way, if you tell us it's really true and we ever find out it isn't and can prove it, you're in jail for a year. Would that be a useful way of modifying our civil and criminal system or not? Yes, well, the divorce one, presumably, I think they can still remarry. I think it's just that you've got, kind of, it's a bride price system, so there are going to be various complications. First, the wife might choose not to remarry, but my guess is that remarrying, you're going to have to pay your kin some more money or something. I don't really know the details. Yes. Yes, well, divorce would be worthless in our system because it's easy to get divorced if you want to, and it's easy to remarry if you want to. Now and being married doesn't matter nearly as much in our system as in most systems, given that people can live together and have children together and so forth without being married, and it's not all that uncommon at this point. So that wouldn't work. But just say take the year in prison as make it a criminal offense. Perjury, imagine for a moment, perjury stops being a criminal offense at all or something. But we say that perjury, when you've aided the additional oath, becomes a serious criminal offense and will prosecute. Yep?
I think the lineage, the lineage, you know, like a system for people to be able to prove their lineage, or are there, like, markings that people put on, like press or children?
I don't think so. I think what's going on is just that everybody except small children has memorized his lineage. After the first step of my lineage, it checks against other people, right? If I don't have an external way of proving who my father was, but there are a bunch of other people descended from that father who know his father and his father and his father were, so I've got to check against that. So I think that's what's going on. I think it's an oral system, but one where lineage is important, and therefore people quite routinely, I gather, that, you know, when you meet somebody, and what do you say? Well, where did you go to college? Or where do you work? Or, you know, something else. What they say is, tell me your lineage. Ha! We join up here. That kind of thing. So I think that's all. It doesn't sound as though there are mechanisms beyond that.
It seems pretty easy to change to a new identity. You just keep saying yes, or a previously undisclosed parent X.
Well, except that there are going to be people who knew parent X, and they're going to know what children he had, and the children were, and who's your mother, and will she tell? I'm not sure it's going to be that easy, or that they will be that willing to do it, given how important lineage is from their standpoint. Now, it's reminding me a little bit, there's a story I read somewhere where somebody who I think is like a white mercenary in Africa at the beginning of the story, and when he finally gets out, he manages to have with him a whole bunch of blank passports from one of the South or Central American countries that's pretty free about giving out passports, which he sells then and he then gets this great idea for supporting himself. And the idea for supporting himself says, look, you go through a border, and the customs people look at your passport. And what do they check? They check, is this person on the Interpol list of wanted people? They check, is this a country on our list of countries that we have bad relations with? What's the one thing they would never bother to check? Does this country exist? So he invents a country, goes to one of the firms that produces passports for small countries, has a bunch of passports made for his imaginary country, and then sells them. And it turns out that there is, in fact, somebody who did something which isn't quite that. But I came across somewhere a reference to somebody who sells identification cards which are designed to look like passports if you don't look very carefully. And it sounds as though they are largely sold to things like American citizens who want to travel in places where being known to be an American citizen is dangerous. and therefore they use these cards, and the customs people in those kinds of places probably aren't terribly sophisticated anyway, and maybe you've got a $20 bill that you slip into the into your supposed passport when you show it to the customs guy, and therefore you can use this as your ID without having to show your American passport. And I thought that was interesting that you had the fictional version and then the true version, which doesn't quite pretend to be a passport, but really does. That's what it sounded to me, at least, that was the scam that he was doing. So I thought that was sort of quite neat. All right, any other things, points you want to discuss? Yes? No? Maybe. Other things of interest? Something I was thinking about a little bit and thought it would be interesting to explore is to what extent we have de facto feud systems in modern societies. And the particular example that occurred to me was patent law. That it's pretty clear that one of the things that's going on in patent law is that you've got a bunch of companies in an industry, each of which has some case for suing somebody else for infringing their patent. And why don't I sue you for infringing my patent? Because if I do, you'll sue me for infringing your patent. And it's not clear whether either of us will win, but we can at least impose sizable costs on each other. And I'd wondered if you could analyze the dynamics of that system as really being a feud system in which the equivalent of using violent force is suing people and therefore imposing costs on them. And similarly, I've argued for some time, I've got this, my first book sketches out a hypothetical, stateless, really feud system in a modern society, a highly organized feud system. And it occurred to me long after I wrote it that you've got a sort of an analog for that in our system in the relation among auto insurance companies. That in my hypothetical system, the firm that enforces my rights has a conflict with the firm that enforces your rights because I claim you robbed me or something. And there are two ways of settling that conflict, exactly as in the Somali case. One of them is to agree to arbitration and one of them is to fight it out. And the question is, what's the equilibrium of that system? Well, think about auto insurance companies. When my car runs into your car, there are two ways they can settle that issue. One of them is to go to court, and that's expensive and risky. And the other is to agree to various rules of thumb between the insurance companies where they say, well, look, under these circumstances, we agree our guy was at fault, and here's how we estimate the costs, and we'll pay, and next time it'll be the other way, and you'll do it the same way. I gather from talking to people in the field, it's not something I've ever seriously researched, that in fact the equilibrium is almost always the peaceful equilibrium. Almost all such conflicts never get to the courts. They are settled privately by the insurance companies, by their own, I don't know if it's explicit arbitration or just rules of thumb that they all know to decide. So I think it's when a car that's moving hits a car that's still, the moving car is assumed to be at fault, even though you can imagine cases where it really was the fault. You know, imagine we're in a shopping center parking lot and I stupidly parked, sticking 10 feet out from the line, and you are coming around the corner, and there was a big truck next to me parked, so you couldn't see me. You ran into me, it's really my fault. But I think if I've got it right, that the insurance companies will agree that it was your fault, and similarly with other things. Yep.
I saw an interesting use of the modern video cameras. This guy was apparently on a freeway in LA, and he's got his video camera running constantly. And the guy in front of him literally stops in traffic and then backs up and runs into him. And then gets out and says, you need to pay me $500, otherwise I'm going to go to the insurance company and it's going to raise your costs. He says, ha ha, I got this all recorded. It's recorded you backing up into me. Then they go away. So, assumption that the guy is moving is the...
But more generally, I was thinking about where else in modern society do you have things that are really feud systems, in that what's really enforcing whatever the rules are is the threat of my imposing costs on you. Yes?
I would say it's got to be found within professional sports teams' interactions with each other.
I don't know.
But baseball would be an example.
Yep.
As far as patent law goes, I think your assumption that it's a feud system is neglecting to consider just how prevalent cross-licensing is. Because the overwhelming majority of patented products have thousands of patents that apply to certain component parts, especially with our technology. And there are almost no cases that I had ever come across. I work in that.
Yep.
Where an infringement goes unprosecuted out of fear or some sort of unwritten mutual respect with other companies, because you know if you're infringing, the cost benefit of seeking a license versus risking a patent suit, you seek a license all the time. I mean, that's why patent trolls exist.
What about a case where the odds of winning the infringement suit are not very high, where it's possible but not probable that you will?
And it's going to be. I mean, patent attorneys are some of the most expensive patent litigators out there. So if the case is where you might not win it at all, it's often better just to settle with a more substantial license than the free market might have got. It's totally cost-benefit because it's so expensive.
But it seems to me that in a sense your settlement really is the equivalent of my arbitration, that you're talking about a system where there's that a well-functioning feud system you almost never fight.
That's not mutual threats, though. That's mutual agreement.
But it's mutual agreement. But you think the only reason that the agreement occurs is because I have money, and not because if we didn't reach an agreement, we would have similar conflicts in the other direction at other times?
Well, but a feud system is established based on mutual respect and mutual fear. The patent system is established based on the patent statute, that the U.S. government is the one who gives the monopoly.
Well, except that there's a sense in which a feud system is established based on the facts of our ability to impose costs on us. That's what the U.S. government is really doing, it seems to me, is the equivalent of setting how easily I can hurt you, how easily you can hurt me. No?
I'm just saying that I wouldn't consider cross-licensing to be a result of a
potential threat.
System.
So you don't think that companies acquire patents that they don't intend to use themselves in order that they have a threat against other companies who have patents that they might be arguably be using?
But I think that exists to facilitate license agreements, which I don't think are inherently aggressive.
But if that facilitates license agreements because the other people are agreeing, because otherwise we might sue them for infringement, isn't that a...
Well, I mean, if you carry that out absurd, then every single form of mutual agreement for this is based on the feud.
I guess I wanted to distinguish ones where the reason for the agreement is that I have money and you have something else you value, like the agreement when I buy something, and the one where I have a way of imposing costs on you and you have a way of imposing costs on me. And somehow those somehow feel different. I'm not sure if I'm right that they're different. But
in corporate context, I think money, whether it's offensive or defensive, is kind of the same.
Maybe. Anyway. But think about other examples. Maybe that's a bad example. But it does seem to me that it's the logic of a noticeable amount of human interaction, and therefore...